So I'm going to be talking about bringing information theory to bear on the analysis of what happens in the kind of basic learning experiment that experimental psychologists have run for the last century or more. And that in the jargon of the field, these are called conditioning experiments. These experiments were undertaken within the associative worldview, which completely dominates thinking about animal learning, particularly among neurobiologists. And in this worldview, the repeated experience of two events leads to the slow development of an association between those events or the internal representations of those events. And these experiments were all intended to reveal the properties of that process, the association forming process. Now, one of my eccentric views is that there's no such thing as an association, and that that people have systematically misconceived what these experiments are about. And I'll begin by reviewing five classic experiments. These are textbook experiments. These were all done in the 60s, all except the last, the conditioned inhibition, which goes all the way back to Pavlov. So in a conditioning experiment, the paradigm of all conditioning experiments is, of course, Pavlov with the bell and the dogs. I assume you all know Pavlov and his dogs. So you have a warning stimulus that you sound, and the stimulus predicts the occurrence of something like food or shock. And after repeated experience of the warning stimulus and the what it predicts, the animal responds to the warning stimulus with what's called a conditioned response, which is basically it shows you in its behavior that it anticipates the occurrence of the U.S. unconditioned stimulus, which is jargon for the thing that is predicted. And I'm going to use that jargon. So the CS is the warning stimulus, the conditioned stimulus that's doing the predicting, and the U.S. is the event that is predicted. So here, these five experiments that I'm going to talk about have been repeated many times. They're extremely well-established phenomena, and they serve to show, in my opinion, why the traditional way of thinking about what's going on is misguided. The first of these is Bob Ruscarla's background conditioning experiment, which is also sometimes called the truly random control. And these experiments will also bring out why an information theoretic analysis might be appropriate, and then I'll proceed to actually do such an analysis. The second experiment is Kamen's blocking experiment. The third is the overshadowing experiment, which is usually attributed to Kamen, but actually Reynolds did a very pretty one several years before Kamen. The fourth is an experiment by Wagner and several collaborators, which is usually called the Q validity or relative Q validity experiment. And the fourth kind of experiment is conditioned inhibition experiment. So here's the first experiment, a truly random control. And here's a way of showing these experimental protocols that I'll use over and over again. This is a timeline, so this is the arrow of time running to the right there. When the warning stimulus comes on, the timeline goes up. When the event that it warns of, the U.S., occurs, there's a dot placed on the line. And then when the warning stimulus goes off, it comes down, and you have the intertrial interval here, the period when there is no warning stimulus, and so on. So in this simple protocol, you'll see that at some point during each of these appearances of the warning stimulus, there is the event, the U.S., which in Ruscarla's experiment was a shock, but the experiment, the results are the same whatever you use. It works just as well if you use food here. And this is, of course, Pavlov's classic experiment with one minor variation, namely that this dot, instead of always occurring just at the end of the warning stimulus, which was typical in Pavlov's experiment, can occur at any point during the warning stimulus. Now, the animals, after repeated experience of this, begin to respond to the warning stimulus in anticipation of the shot. I mean, they basically, they do this, they hunker down, they do just what you would do if you were getting shocks to your feet every now and then. The traditional understanding of this is that there's a temporal conjunction, a temporal pairing of the warning stimulus and the U.S., and that that temporal pairing is, the repeated occurrence of that temporal pairing is what gives rise to an associative connection in the brain, a change in synaptic conductance, if you like. And what Rescorla realized is that, well, there are two ways of looking at what's going on here, and they're dissociable. So there's temporal pairing, that's true, but there's also contingency in the statistical or information processing sense. He never formulated it as information processing, but he did formulate it as contingency. That is, the CS is providing information about when the U.S. will occur. And you can eliminate that information without touching the temporal pairing just by filling in, sprinkling at random other dots on the intervals when the warning stimulus isn't sounding, and you make them sufficiently frequent so that the frequency during the warning stimulus is no different from the frequency in the absence of the warning stimulus. Right? So now the warning stimulus has no information content regarding when or how often you can expect the U.S. So you've eliminated the contingency, but he deliberately coupled one group of animals to another group of animals in such a way that he exactly preserved the temporal pairing, so that in every case in which the CS and the U.S. are paired in this record, there's an identical pairing in that record.
The total number of U.S. stimuli for group 2 is greater than group 1.
Yes, he had a control in which, Rescorla is a master of design, and he had a control in which he varied it in the opposite way so as to keep the total number the same and also eliminate the contingency. I'm not showing it here, but it didn't matter how he did it. The result was the same, namely that when you gave them this protocol, they don't learn to respond to the CS when you do give them this. So this suggests that the implication is that it's contingency, not temporal pairing, that drives the process. Now, here's the Kamen's blocking experiment. And in a blocking experiment, you have two stimuli, two warning stimuli, which I've symbolized here by the horizontal bars and the red. And when they're presented together or in compound, then the horizontal bars are superimposed upon the red. And there are two phases to a blocking experiment. In the first phase, you train with one or another of these two stimuli. In a well-controlled experiment, obviously, half the animals are trained with one of them and half of them are trained with the other. And once they've developed a conditioned response to a single stimulus, you then present the stimuli in compound. So again now, when you get to this second phase of the experiment where you're presenting the red and the horizontal bars together, you're, of course, pairing the Johnny-come-lately stimulus is now being temporally paired with the U.S. So if temporal pairing was what drove conditioning, then you should get conditioning to that, to the more recently introduced stimulus. But of course, from an information processing perspective, the new stimulus isn't telling it anything that it doesn't already know from the old stimulus. That is, the new stimulus is perfectly redundant with the old stimulus. And again, the result that you find is that the animal never develops a conditioned response to the stimulus that's introduced second here, right? That's what this group is here, see? So here, this group is trained with one stimulus and this trained with the other. The result's the same. Okay? Whichever one is trained first blocks conditioning to the one that's introduced second.
I think we started to place things, sort of make sure that 90% of the times they are redundant, but 10% of the times the second one
is not redundant. If people played all that kind of game, and if the second stimulus does provide information, then you do get a conditioned response to the second state. So, for example, you can, as you said, you can vary that, or you can make the shock or the food bigger once you introduce the compound, if you do that, or smaller. And if you do that, the animal develops a conditioned response to the one that is introduced second. So again, this implies that temporal pairing is not sufficient for conditioning. You can temporally pair until the cows come home and without getting conditioning with a perfectly conditionable stimulus. You get, the way Kamen summarized it was that you get conditioning only if the U.S. surprises the subject, and Kamen put those scare quotes around surprise, because Kamen, like most of the people running these, was a behaviorist, and surprise had connotations of expectation and all kinds of behaviorally suspect notions about what might be going on in the head of the animal, and so he felt uncomfortable using such a term in a scientific discovery. Of course, an information theoretic analysis will show us how to get rid of the scare quotes around surprise. Now, here's the overshadowing experiment, and this is the Reynolds version of the overshadowing experiment. The difference between the overshadowing and the blocking experiment is that in the blocking experiment, the redundant stimulus appears later. In the overshadowing experiment, you're given redundant stimuli from the beginning. So from the beginning of training, there are two stimuli and that are always presented together that carry exactly the same information and that predict the U.S. And the way Reynolds ran this experiment, where this was published in Science, and it had only two pigeons as a total subject. And he taught both pigeons. So the pigeons are learning to peck a illuminated key that appears on the wall of their chamber, and you can vary the pattern that that you have on the key. And the pigeons have excellent color vision. In fact, they're tetrachromats. And on one of the two keys that appeared on the wall, there was a red background with a white triangle superimposed on it, and on the other key, there was a green background with a white circle superimposed upon it. When the pigeons pecked this key, they got food, but they never got food when they pecked that key, and after a while, the pigeons both learned to peck this key and not that key. And then he tested them on trials, on short sessions in which they got no reinforcement at all, because he just wants to see what they make of these stimuli. He tested them with the red background alone, the green background alone, the triangle alone, and the circle alone, and here's the results from one bird, and here's the results from the other bird. And what you can see is that this bird concluded that the triangle was the guilty party, and this bird concluded that the red background was the guilty party. But the important thing to notice that each bird has illuminated one of the, that is, each bird has fastened on one of the two stimuli. And there's no, the beauty of this experiment is you can't reasonably argue that either bird didn't see the other stimulus, right? There's no way to peck the triangle without seeing the red background and vice versa. So again, it suggests a kind of information theoretic principle, namely that if you've got redundant channels, you can maximize your bandwidth by only attending to one of them. This now brings us to the Wagner relative validity experiment, which is in effect a fancier version of the same thing. Again, this is an experiment in which there's redundancy, but now there's a more intricate redundancy in the pattern of, again, you have multiple predictors, they're presented together, but it's a more intricate pattern. So there are two groups of subjects, and in the relative cue validity experiment, and there is one predictive stimulus called the X stimulus, which occurs on every trial. There's two other predictive stimuli which never occur together. That's the horizontal bars and the on the vertical bars called A and B here, but which, so the A stimulus occurs together with X on half the trials, and the B stimulus occurs together with X on half the trials. So A and B never occur together, right? They always occur in combination with X, but they're randomly paired with X. And that's true for both of these groups. So far everything I've said is true for both groups of animals in this experiment. Moreover, it's the animal, the reinforcement, the US, is presented also on half the trials. And again, that's true for both of the groups. And so far everything's the same. So what's different? Well, what's different is how you distribute the reinforcements in accord with the pairings here. So on, for this group of animals, the dots, the US's, occur on half of the AX trials, and they also occur on half of the BX trials. Okay? Whereas for this group of animals, the reinforcements, the dots, occur just on the AX trials. Now remember, the AX trials are half the trials. So both groups of animals got the red, the X, reinforced half the time. So again, if it's just how often a stimulus is being reinforced, as opposed to how good a predictor it is, then both groups of animals should show, when you test them, so after running a lengthy training session of this kind, you then, as in the previous experiment, you have a short session in which you test them with the individual elements presented in isolation. So now they hear X alone, they see or hear A and B alone, and so on. And you see that, again, there's a dramatic difference in what the animals have concluded for this experiment. So this group of animals are responding entirely to the X stimulus, and this group of animals is responding entirely to the A stimulus, even though all the stimuli were reinforced, well, all the stimuli were reinforced half the time in this group, right? A and B were reinforced just as often as X. They were all reinforced half the time, right? But X is the only one that got any credit here. Now, if you handed this protocol to someone in the statistics department and said, this is a multivariate time series problem, and I want you to run this through your computer and figure out which one of these stimuli is doing the heavy lifting here, right? Which one is accounting for all the variance in a stepwise multiple regression, well, the program would conclude that X was accounting for all the variance for this group and that A was accounting for all the variance in that group. So the animals look to be, from this point, solving this multivariate time series problem. So again, the conclusion is that temporal pairing is not what's driving conditioning. What's driving conditioning is the information and the relative amount of information that the various warning stimuli carry about when the US occurs. And now we come kind of full circle here. If you remember the protocol that I started with the first time, the very first protocol I showed you, the top line had the dots only on the CSs. There were no dots during the intertrial interval, and then we introduced a protocol in which there were as many dots during the intertrial interval as there were during the CS. And if anybody with a feel for systematic would say, gee, what happens if if all the dots fall during the intertrial intervals and none of them fall during the CS? Now notice, when you do that, you've restored contingency, right? Now there's differential expectations between the CS and the US, but now the nature of the contingency has reversed, that you've now you have a negative contingency rather than a positive contingency. And that's this protocol here, which is called the explicitly unpaired protocol. And the animals condition perfectly well to this protocol, but not surprisingly, they learn the opposite conditioned response. So if these are shocks, the US's, and if they occur during the CS, then in response to the CS, the animal would freeze, hunker down. In this protocol, what the animal learns to do is in effect relax during the CS, and you can measure that in various ways. I won't give you the gory details, but there's a very clear, you can track the development of this relaxation response very nicely. In this protocol, the dots occur only when the red is present, and whenever the second stimulus is superposed on it, then the dots don't occur. This is the protocol that Pavlov pioneered. And again, In this protocol, the animal develops a response to the horizontal bars that is the opposite of its response to the red. So you get a conditioned response in this case too. Well, so in this case, all the previous experiments showed that temporal pairing was not sufficient to produce conditioning, and this experiment shows it's also not necessary to produce conditioning. So at this point, we've shown that temporal pairing is neither necessary nor sufficient to produce conditioning, and we've shown that negative contingency is just as effective as positive contingency.
Is this true for only higher animals, or
this is true for rats and pigeons and rabbits, the usual suspects?
Cortex, big brain, etc. So
well,
does this work for a worm?
It works for aplysia, the background conditioning. Ruth Colwell ran in Kandel's lab ran the background conditioning experiment with aplysia, and it worked fine. The first of experiments that I showed you. I'm not sufficiently on top of what's been done with invertebrates and the others that I would want to say without, that's the one experiment that I have sharply in mind. Various of these have been done with invertebrates, but I don't trust myself to summarize what the upshot is. Now, there's something very strange. These experiments are very well known, and they're conducted by many of the leaders in the field. In fact, in many cases, they were what made those people leaders, and they were made them famous in the first place. And since they all show that temporal pairing is neither necessary nor sufficient for the establishment of conditioning, you would think that if you opened up a textbook, people would say, well, whatever conditioning is about, it's not about temporal pairing. Neither can be further from the truth. You open up a textbook written in the last couple of years, and you get the strong impression that temporal pairing is really what drives conditioning. And among neurobiologists, this is regarded as if it was handed down along with the tablets. I mean, most of them are just can't believe that there's any doubt about this, that it is the sine qua non for a conditioning. So there's got to be a conceptual problem here. I mean, if people are this resistant to the conclusion that temporal pairing is irrelevant in conditioning, they must be something that's blocking them. And I think Ruscolla, with his usual perspicuity, put his finger right on it. Here's, I think, what's bothering people is that they conceive of learning, they're convinced that the learning has to occur in associative terms. And as Ruscolla says here, we provide the animal with individual events, not correlation or information. And an adequate theory must detail how these events individually affect the animal. That is to say, we need a theory based on individual events.
Just interrupt you for a moment. Isn't there a potential confounding that presumed animals, that people certainly believe that events over a small time interval are more likely to offer a contingency than events separated by long time intervals? And presumably also your animals too, if there are enormous time intervals between conditioned and unconditioned stimuli, would never pair the two.
Actually, that's a very strong intuition. I agree that that's a very strong intuition that people have, that they think that that can't be false. I think it is basically false, particularly what you said at the end. But I think I'm now regretting that I left out a slide that I had in this talk because it speaks exactly to that. But I think the analysis that I offer explains why that's such a strong intuition. The first thing I would observe is that what's a short time interval to a geologist is an eternity to an invertebrate biologist. Right? I mean, if I could show that the extinction of the dinosaurs happened within 100 years of the impact of the comet, I think most geologists would say, oh, well, clearly the comet caused the impact, right? Whereas, of course, a lapse of 100 years between the onset of a bell and the delivery of food would leave the subject dead. One of the properties of the conditioning process that John Gibbon and I have stressed is that it is time scale invariant. In other words, that all intervals are relative. So the short time interval is relative to whatever the base rate expectation is. There is no such thing as an absolute short time interval. Now, since life is not time scale invariant, right? You know, in the long run, we're dead, right? You know that there are limits, that this isn't physics, right? That there are limits to this time scale invariance, but it holds over a surprisingly big range. But now returning to this correlation, right? I mean, what Roscarla says there, it sounds very reasonable, except if you think about it, it's clearly wrong. We do present correlations. In fact, when you're designing these experiments, that's exactly what you're working with in your head. You're saying, well, what if I correlate this CS in such and such a way? So you arrange the CSs so that they're correlated to varying degrees with the US. So what it presumably meant is that, of course there are correlations, but correlations is some fancy thing that only exists in the heads of mathematicians like ourselves. And it isn't substantial enough to drive associations. That is, that what he must have really meant, and then I've actually checked this with him, I know him, and I think he agrees that this is what he meant, is that information is too insubstantial to increment associations. You need physically measurable events to.
That's a question I'm a little confused. Yeah. An association is correlation. What is an association?
Well, an association, so it depends on which science we're working in. In psychology, an association is a hyphen on the blackboard linking to a CS and a US, right? It's like a gene. It's a physically undefined concept, but you imagine there's a connection of some kind and you suppose it's in the brain. And generally you don't want to be pushed further. Well, actually you do, because in my jaundiced view, part of the reason for the enduring popularity of the associative concept is that it's neurobiologically transparent, by which I mean it has a fairly obvious interpretation as what it could be in the brain. And what is generally taken to be in the brain is it's a change in synaptic conductance, which you'll notice is the psychologist's conception, but now translated into physiological language. More specifically, these days, it's commonly imagined to be LTP, which is a mechanism or collection of mechanisms which change synaptic conductance. So that's, now there was another question.
I have some question about decision gene. I mean, you discussed whether this temporal condition is important or not important for learning.
Yeah.
But why do you think that all learning processes, the same things are important for all learning processes? Maybe for some learning processes, is this important, for some it's not?
That's a terrific question. I couldn't agree more. That's why I call this conditioning, not learning. Okay, so. In the worldview from which this came, there is only one basic learning process. Oh, there are a few other trivial ones like habituation and so on, but there's only one learning process that really matters. That's associative learning. And these paradigms were devised precisely because they capture the essence of what one imagines associative learning is about. And the assumption is that associative learning somehow explains all kinds of other things, like learning where things are. Do I myself regard that as a plausible worldview? No, I regard it. I've written a whole book attacking that worldview root and branch, arguing that it is a wildly implausible view, in fact, a ridiculous view, and that the kind of analysis that you would apply to these kinds of data is transparently not applicable to learning where things are, or learning a language for that matter, and so on. So I'm with you when it comes to that. But I'm focusing now on just these, which, in my worldview, they have something in common that begs for an information theoretic analysis, namely they're all multivariate non-stationary time series problems. Now, they weren't conceived as such. People didn't think that that's what they were designing. But if you just look, if you wandered in from the statistics department and said, what do all these experiments have in common? What they all have in common is that they're multivariate non-stationary time series problem. Here's where we can start to remove the scare quotes from around surprise, because Kamen was at Princeton after the experiment, actually, but he moved to Princeton, and when he was at Princeton, he was only about 40 miles south of Murray Hill, where Shannon was, right? And of course, Shannon was the one who gave us a way, made information, if you like, substantial, or at least rigorously defined and readily usable in scientific undertakings. So this gives us a starting point for a true information theoretic analysis, because we're going to have to say what information is. And in more particularly, what do we mean when we say the CS provides information about the US? So, of course, as you all know, on Shannon's analysis, the information that a signal or an event provides to a subject is measured by the reduction in the subject's uncertainty, the receiver's uncertainty. And that leads immediately to a set of straightforward principles that can be developed mathematically to give us an information theoretic analysis of these protocols. The first principle is that subjects respond only to informative CSs. And so now we have to do, what do we mean by informative CSs? Well, a CS is, on this story, a CS is informative to the extent that it changes the subject's uncertainty about the time of the to the next US. And then we naturally bring in a few fairly standard principles, Occam's razor, that is bandwidth maximization. You want to put as much information as possible into as few carriers as possible. Notice that the information in a protocol is carried now by the very abstract parts of the protocol, namely the temporal intervals between the events. The events are now, it's like the when you apply information processing to the analysis of spike trains, right? It's not the spikes that matter, it's the intervals between the spikes, right? Similarly, from this kind of perspective, it's not the events that matter. Of course, they do matter in the end, but it's the information is carried by the numbers of events and the intervals between events. So one of the unusual aspects of this is that it says those kinds of things that are, it's often been imagined that only humans appreciate time intervals and numbers because they're somehow very abstract, very far removed from experience and so on. If this kind of analysis is correct, that's almost exactly wrong. That is, duration and number are the primitives, the bedrock on which simple learning is built. Now, another very important, something that enters in importantly, and particularly in what I'll do in the rest of today's talk, is Weber's law, there's a rich experimental literature on the representation of number and time by animals of the same kind that participate in these experiments, pigeons, rats, rabbits. And what the best established empirical result in that literature is that the uncertainty with which an animal can represent a time interval or a number is itself scale invariant. In other words, it's a plus or minus a fixed percentage, and that percentage is approximately 15%. So when you test the animals in various ways for how accurately they remember the duration of the CS-US interval, how long it was between the onset of the CS and the appearance of the US, they remember it plus or minus 15%. And that's true over intervals ranging from a fraction of a second to about an hour or more. And we don't know beyond that because you run into practical difficulties when you start testing. But it's true over at least a couple of orders of magnitude. Yes, that value is approximately the same for the mouse, the rat, the pigeon, and the human being. It's a little better in the human. It's more like 12% in the human being. But it's surprisingly similar across a range of...
To believe that it has to be this way,
I've thought about that question. None that I've been able to think of, but I... it's an interesting question, why it's this way and why that... I mean, of course, it's what it means is that animals, in effect, are obeying a kind of scientific notation principle. They're representing quantities to a fixed number of significant digits, if you like. Yes?
Well, so how do you query the animal? So just when the rat starts licking the faucet.
Yeah, so let me tell you how you do it in the case of the time interval. There are a number of tasks, but the most commonly used task is the peak procedure. And in the peak procedure, a warning stimulus comes on, and at the end of some fixed interval, if the animal makes a response, sticks its head in the feeding hopper or pecks the key, it will get food on most but not all trials. And it's wasting its time responding sooner than that. And on some trials, these are so-called probe trials, on which the food is never programmed. And so once the set interval is passed, if the animal makes a response and doesn't get food, it's wasting its time continuing to respond because it's not going to get food in that. And you can look at the animals routinely learn to bracket the expected time of food. So they start responding somewhat before the food is expected, and they stop responding a while after the food is responding. And of course, there's variability from trial to trial on when they start and when they stop. And oddly enough, the stops rather than the starts are more tightly controlled. And if you look at the coefficient of variation in the stop distribution, right? The standard deviation in that distribution divided by the mean of that distribution, it's right around 0.15. And you can run this experiment with rabbits, pigeons, rats, mice, humans, and you get very similar results and a very similar coefficient of variation for the stop distribution. The starts are much messier. You get a much larger coefficient of variation in the starts. Well, but we think we know why that's the case. Anyway, that's where this estimate comes from. You can do similar things with number. In this definition of information, you have to assume that the animal not only represents the possible outcomes, but its uncertainty about them. That is, that the animal's not only representing the expected time of the next reinforcement, but it's representing how uncertain it is about that expected time. And the question naturally arises, what would be a felicitous form of this representation? And I've been suggesting that a felicitous form is the cumulative probability function, because it's very easily constructed from a small amount of experience, and much better behaved than the probability density function itself. Here, this graph shows you the limiting cases on the uncertainty. So suppose the animal's in an environment, and something that it's interested in predicting, like food or shock, happens every now and then. Okay? And the animal's interested in narrowing down as much as it can the interval in which it should expect this thing to happen. And you're supplying, you either are or are not supplying warning signals. Let's take the first case where you're not supplying warning signals, and this event is a random rate process, the occurrence of food, right? So it's equally likely at every moment. Then, of course, the cumulative probability function is the inverse exponential here. And of course, as the animal advances along the time axis, the function advances with it. That is, the elapsing of time does not change this cumulative probability function. The animal is always standing at the bottom of the function. Now let's take, so that's the case of maximum uncertainty. Right, and of course, the function's entirely characterized just by its rate parameter, which is just the number of occurrences that the animal has observed divided by the time during which it's been observing, right? So it's a very easily characterized and easily estimated function. Now, the opposite limit is when there's a warning signal that comes on that exactly predicts when the event is going to occur here at the lapse of this interval here. Now, if the animal could represent duration with arbitrary precision, then the cumulative probability function would be this step function. But I just finished telling you that the animal can only represent intervals to an accuracy of plus or minus 15%. So because of that limit on the precision with which the animal can represent the intervals, the cumulative probability function in this case becomes the cumulative Gaussian with a standard deviation equal to 15% of the mean, which is the green curve here. So these two cumulative probability functions represent the opposite ends of the certainty-uncertainty scale. This is maximum uncertainty, and this is the maximum attainable certainty. So now the question I'm going to address is whether this way of looking at things has any quantitative bite. The principles that I gave you, even without mathematical development, predict all those experimental results that I went through the first time. Because I'm taking this audience is more sophisticated than most, I'm not even going to bother to show it. I think it would be more or less obvious if you think about it. Because in all of those experiments, if the CS had a non-zero information content defined as I've defined it, then the animal responded, and if it had zero information content, then the animal didn't respond. And the bandwidth maximization gave you the redundancy results, the results in which the animal singled out one stimulus from among a number of more or less equal predictors. So now I'm going to go on to ask whether just calculating the amount of information that a protocol has provided to an animal enables you to predict when animals in different conditions will begin to respond in this situation. So remember, you start showing them these protocols, and in most of these protocols they don't respond until they've seen quite a number of these warning stimuli. And there are parameters of the protocol that you can manipulate that have a big impact on how soon they begin to respond. So for example, if you space the CSs a long ways apart so that the CSs occupy a small proportion of the total time, then the animals begin to respond much sooner. And of course, you say, gee, they also have a much higher information content under those circumstances, right? If you if you don't present the US, the dot, on every time on which the CS occurs, but only occasionally, then you of course reduce the information content, and it takes more presentations of the CS before the animals begin to respond. So there are a number of manipulations that we can make that alter how many reinforcements the animal has to experience before, how many successful predictions in effect it has to experience before it begins to respond. And the question that we want to ask is, all of these manipulations alter the information content of the average CS, and can we predict the effects of these manipulations by just calculating the effects of the manipulation on the information content of the CS? That's what I'm doing in the rest of this talk. Do you have a question?
Oh, sorry, I was trying to phrase it in my head. Can I rephrase what you're saying?
Sure.
That really I have this underlying distribution, which is a function of two variables, the CS and the US. And you're given a certain number of samples, you're trying to figure out then something about that distribution. It could be the mutual information between those two variables, it could be something else, and that's really what you're probing. Is that fair, is the question?
I think as I go on you'll see exactly what I'm up to, and it's I think you'll be reasonably happy with the way you paraphrased what I was saying. But before I get into the heart of it, I want to mention one other thing that you might be wondering, well, how well marked is this thing I'm trying to predict? I'm trying to predict when the animal begins to respond. Now, if you took introductory psychology, you got the impression, I think, that when the animal only very slowly began to respond, because as the association slowly got stronger, right? That you had a little bit of responding and then more responding and then more responding and then more responding. In other words, there's a widespread impression that the onset of conditioned responding in the course of these protocols is not a well-marked event because it's very gradual. I just have to disabuse you of that. I have a paper that just came out in the PNAS last week from which this graph comes, but the whole point of the paper is that it ain't so. That in fact, in a very wide variety of simple conditioning experiments, the onset of responding is abrupt and very well marked and easy to, in other words, the animal isn't responding or it's responding at some low base rate, and then boom, within the span of a very few trials, most commonly within the span of one trial, but the animal begins to respond at a level that approximates its asymptotic response rate. And in fact, we approached this analysis in a number of ways, but one way is just to fit the cumulative Weibull function to the responses. So you just plot the responses as a function of trials, and so you get dot, 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 and you fit a cumulative Weibull function to that, and you ask how steep the Weibull function is. We did that for 105 pigeons, and here's the median Weibull function. I've normalized here for purposes of comparison, making the halfway point in the Weibull function equal to 1. And if you're saying, well, is that abrupt? Well, of course, abruptness is in the eye of the beholder, but I thought, well, what do people generally think of as abrupt? Well, people think of sensory thresholds as abrupt. Maybe they shouldn't, but they tend to think of sensory thresholds as abrupt. So one measure of abruptness is how steep is this Weibull function relative to the function that describes the transition from not seeing a light to seeing a light as you make the light brighter and brighter under optimal conditions. That's the Hesch, Schleyer, and Perrin experiment. And here's the Weibull function for Hesch, Schleyer, and Perrin experiment. So this is the threshold function, or what? That's misleading. But this is the psychometric function for the detection of a flash of light under optimal conditions in the dark adapted observer. And this is from some work by David Green in psychoacoustics. This is the psychometric function for detecting a tone in white noise. And as you can see, the onset of conditioned behavior is more abrupt than are these functions. The really important thing is not whether it's quote abrupt or not, but it's well marked. It can be very easily and objectively identified. Now another point is that this doesn't fit, this abrupt appearance, is much more congruent with the idea that what you're really looking at here is the result of an evidence-based decision process, which is the kind of framework I'm talking about. The animal's been watching this thing, and after a while it says, oh, all right, I've got enough evidence to conclude that this really does predict that, and once it passes that threshold, it begins to respond. Yes?
There's been work about 10, 15 years back by Hans and Bellings, Tishby, and Sebastian, so on phase transitions in learning, where they basically show that such effects can happen even from continuous smooth acquisition of data.
Yeah. There's no question they can, because if you have a continuous smooth increase in and then you view it through a very narrow window with a high threshold and a low saturation level, then you're going to get this kind of, I mean, you can always make a continuous variable discontinuous through a decision-like process.
More or less, right. So did you try to compare what you're addressing here to some of the predictions which they made? And the point, the reason for the predictions that, that they were making were how does the apparent abruptness change as a function of the variability of the signals that you look at?
Right. No, we didn't. I didn't make an attempt to model this. What I concluded from this is if you imagine that, well, under both stories you have some sort of slowly increasing variable underneath, either an associative strength or a decision variable, right? And on both stories you then have something that amounts to a thresholding operation. The important point, for present purposes, the only important point is that the onset is well marked. But the more general point is that it's generally been imagined that you could, that the strength of the behavior was a monotonic function of the strength of the association over some non-trivial interval above the threshold, right? And this analysis says no, that essentially a negligible, if you think that there's an association getting stronger there, then a negligible portion of that function is behaviorally visible. Because the only way you can capture this kind of result is if there's a high threshold and a low saturation level. So,
I mean, you may have, I mean, what those words you prefer to talk about is that when given some set of appropriate priors and given the observations, you might have two very close explanations for, mm-hmm. for the observed data. And then you have something like, you know, I think the basic first order or you know, second order phase transition where two observations are possible and the choice which you make depends very much on your prior history or on some randomness in the signal, some noise in the signal. There are two explanations equally plausible. Not that you are thresholding some smooth function, but really two explanations are possible and nothing in the middle is.
Yeah.
This has different, I mean, there would be hysteresis property attached to that, there wouldn't be hysteresis attached to thresholding a smooth condition.
Yeah. Well, there certainly is hysteresis in these learning effects. I'll have to pursue that further with you later. Okay, so now basically I just want to do this calculation that we were discussing a moment ago. But so here I just want to introduce what I think is the right kind of perspective to have in mind in doing this. So you start out with, here's a random rate event, right? These point events are occurring in time at exponentially distributed inter-event intervals, and so they're equally likely at every moment in time. And now we're going to start predicting them in various ways, right? By putting these little warning, positioning these warning stimuli in time so as to predict them in various ways. One thing we can do is always predict position a warning stimulus over an event, but otherwise not constrain where the event falls within the warning stimulus, which is what you see here. So then now what you have in this situation is basically a rate change. The rate at which these events occur is considerably higher in when the stimulus is present than when the stimulus is absent. But that's the only source of predictability. That's the only change in the entropy. Is the change in the rate. Yeah. So that's in some sense the simplest possible case, and that's exactly what Rescorla did in his random, truly random control. Here's the case in which the events only, this is called partial reinforcement by psychologists, so the dots only occur during the CSs, but not every CS predicts it. A dot. Now we introduce the sort of opposite case in which some of the dots are predicted by CSs and some aren't. This is called the poor positive case. This is what's called a partial poor positive because there's still some information content to the CS. The rate is higher during the CS than during the US, but not as high as it would be if you took away these dots here. And here's the truly random control, in which the rate of dot occurrence during the CS is the same as during the US. So this is the limiting case of the poor positive. And here's the inhibitory case, in which you position these dots, but you take care, or these predictors, rectangles, but you take care that they always fall in the inner event interval. So now they signal a lower rate of occurrence of events. So now we can start to analyze the entropies on these various conditions, starting with that first one, the one in which the only change when the CS comes on is the change in the rate parameter of a random rate process. And these formulae are taken basically directly out of the Sven Stevenick and so on book on the application of information theoretic analysis to neural signaling. The first formula at the top here is the formula for the rate of information, the amount of information per unit time in an exponential, in a random rate process. Right. And then that leads to this nice formula here, in which it depends only on the entropy depends only on the rate parameter, as you would expect. Of course, you've got this constant k, but the nice thing is that when you consider the change in entropy, this constant k goes away, and so you get that the average number of bits of Shannon information that the onset of the CS communicates to the animal under that simplest of condition is simply the log to the base 2 of the ratio of the two rate parameters. Right? And so now we say, okay, that's the average amount of information that the CS conveys about the timing of the US per presentation. Now let us look at how many successfully signaling events. We have data on when pigeons began to respond under that kind of protocol, and now let us see if we calculate the amount of information that they had received from this warning signal at the point in the protocol where they began to respond. Is it clear what we're up to here? Which is, of course, just the amount of information per in the average warning times the number of warnings they had received at the point at which they began to respond. So we calculate that quantity for each bird. And now these, one of the things you'll see in these distributions is that when the birds begin to respond, there's a lot of variability. Some birds begin to respond early and some birds begin to respond late. In presenting these data, I'm always going to present them in the form of cumulative distributions. So on this axis, we have the amount of Shannon information, the number of bits that the animal had received from the warning stimulus at the point the animal began to respond. And on this axis, we have the number of the fraction of the total sample of birds run that had begun to respond by that amount of information, right? So after 20 bits, basically, nobody had begun to respond. And by the time you get out here to 320 bits, basically everybody had begun to respond. And this shows you the distribution in between. But this first analysis here contrast the first two cases that I considered in the protocol. So the first, we began with the random rate case. Then we considered the case in which the CS is superimposed, but there's no timing information within the CS. And the next case is where the CS is superimposed and the dot always comes at the end of the CS. So you you can decompose, there's more information conveyed by the CS under the second protocol than there is in the first protocol, right? Because you have, the second protocol has the change in rate, plus on top of that, you have the ability to predict when during the CS the US will occur. And in this analysis, what I did was decompose the change in entropy into its two components, the component due to the change in the rate and the component due to the fixed time information. Yes?
Are you saying that it takes time, as long as it takes frame to get this information, whatever is the protocol, just whatever way you present the information, takes some time, the necessary amount of information to be absorbed by anyone?
No, that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is, well, all I'm doing is making a calculation, really. In fact, I'm not entirely, when I'm done with this, what I want to say about what this means, I'm not quite so sure. You'll see why. But I'm just, I calculate every time the animal gets a warning, it gets, on average, a certain amount of information. Right? After some number of warnings, it begins to respond.
But can I translate it into information to language? I mean, animal starts to respond after he got some information, sufficient amount of information.
Yeah.
So but this logic doesn't depend on the way how I was given this information.
So I'm not.
I guess the question is the following: if you do a different, slightly different experiment with different rates, both the Monday CS and RAM London base, as long as the difference is the same, is it true that independently of the rates?
Yeah, actually, that's this black curve. So. This black curve is from a whole, years ago, back in the early 80s, Gibbon and Balsam collected data from a variety of different labs in which they used a whole variety of different rates, different CS durations, different intervals between them, and so on. And they plotted, in fact, this well-known plot of theirs is partly what inspired this analysis. They plotted the number of reinforcements to acquisition, how many times they, how many warnings, successful warnings they had to receive before they began to respond, as a function of the ratio between the two rates, the two inner, the intertrial interval and the CS duration, and this formed a straight line with slope almost minus one on a log-log plot. In other words, this is the qualitatively what I referred to earlier, that if the ratio between the duration of the CS and the intervals when the CS isn't on, if that's very large, which means that the rate difference is very high, then the animals begin to respond after a very few experiences. Whereas if that ratio is low, then they take a great many experiences before they begin to respond. Have I answered? I think your question had to do something with the latency for them to begin to respond. But these protocols are very slow relative to how quickly the animal can implement a decision once it's taken. I'm not sure this gets at your question, but so we're talking minutes here, right? I mean, the bird sits there for a couple minutes, nothing happens, then the light comes on for 5 seconds, and then it gets food, right? And that happens some number of times, and eventually, lo and behold, when the light comes on, the bird pecks at it. And what that's what we're looking at here, yeah.
There are good learners and bad learners in the sense that if you pick up a single, if you pick up a single bird and you present a different experimental conditions to it so that the rates are different, that this particular bird, independent on the rate, starts to respond after 20 bits, while the other bird, independent on the rate, starts to respond after 100 bits.
Well, for reasons because of what we were talking about before when I talked, you and I, that experiment is very hard to run because the animal's previous learning experience has a huge impact on how rapidly it begins to respond in this situation. So that raises a very substantial methodological difficulty. Trouble is, you in effect can't measure the same bird twice because he's had.
Well, you can, but that sort of probes that probes starts to probe the priors.
Exactly. So, one of my major goals is to try and develop a successful model of just that phenomenon. But it stands in the way of addressing the individual difference question that Ilya was posing.
It's a mathematical question. It seems that your previous computations are on the assumption that trials are independent.
Yes, that's
but
true.
They are not independent here.
Why do you say that?
Because you have memory.
Well, but the amount of information, I mean, it's true that my
The formulas are correct, but under the assumption that trials are independent. But it seems to be that the model is not such, or I'm not.
No, so I think
it's independent.
I'm not.
But yeah. The question is not about the bird, the question is.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Yeah, information has the experiment provided.
But yeah. It's real only in the case when trials are independent. It says dependence.
In the experiment, the trials are independent. Whether the bird keeps the history of them and makes some kind of analysis and calculation.
Yeah, Ilya, so that's exactly right. I'm not testing a model of what's going on in the head of the bird here, okay? This is, in fact, this is, though of course I have in mind to use this as a constraint on what's going on in the head of the bird. But as Ilya just said, that I'm just calculating the objective for the mutual information in the protocol, okay? At considering the stretch of protocol up to the point where the animal began. All right, that's all I'm doing here. But in this analysis, which I was in the midst of explaining, the red distribution is from birds in which the CS-US interval was fixed. In other words, the US occurred at a fixed time after the onset of the CS. Whereas the green distribution, which essentially superposes on the red distribution, is from a group of animals in which there was a variable CS-US interval, so you couldn't predict when the CS came on. You could predict that a reinforcement would occur, but you couldn't predict when exactly it would occur. And so there was more information per CS for this group of animals than there was for this group of animals, but if you calculate the full amount of information, the curves don't superpose. These animals, the red group curve lies over here. To get them to superpose, I ignored the information, the component of the information that came from the fixed CS-US interval, right? I in effect assumed that the animal was oblivious to the fixed duration. Now we know that's false. We know the animal is not oblivious to the fixed duration, okay? But I said, well, I'm just messing around here, right? So let's see what happens if you take that out. And when you take that out, then the curves superpose. And I'm going to do that in each of the next steps. I'm ignoring in everything that follows until the last one, I'm ignoring this extra information that comes from the fixed time.
There's not that much information there, right?
No, it's actually a lot.
There is 15%. I mean,
it's 2 bit. Well, actually, didn't I show the formula here? Well, here's the extra information. It's 2 bits per occurrence, which is equal to a fourfold difference in the ratios. It's a lot. Here's the extra information due to the using W. So here's where, remember this 15%. Here's where the 15% comes in, right? Because of course the entropy of a Gaussian depends upon the width of the on sigma, right? And that's where this 15% comes in. So then we bring in the ones where it's only partially reinforced. That is where each CS doesn't, the dots only occur during the CSs, but not every CS has a dot, okay? And that's the blue curve, and that falls right in. I mean, so far, this calculation in which we ignore the information, the component of information due to the fixed time, seems to be doing a pretty good job of predicting when in the course of these protocols the animals will begin to respond. And now we bring in the poor positive protocols, the ones in which you have dots during the, you have unwarned dots, you have dots during the intertrial interval, unpredicted dots. That's the red curve, and this black curve is now all these, I've thrown all those other curves together because they look like they were superposing. And as you can see, these birds are doing too well. It's very counterintuitive. The poor positive, the intuition people have is you're degrading the information content, and so they acquire more slowly. They do acquire more slowly, but not nearly as much as more slowly as they ought to if you take into account the degradation. So in terms of their beginning to respond when they've gotten fewer bits. So I mean, this is what I'm now going to do is completely shameless. Okay, I'm like Newton. I'm having my cake and eating it too, right? That is, I've been ignoring this extra component of information when I needed to ignore it in order to make the curve superimpose. But I'm not publishing this. I'm just messing around here. So what if we recalculate for these animals and now we take into account the additional entropy that we've so far been ignoring. Right, and now, lo and behold, it looks like that gets the curves to superpose. So, and one of the curious things, I have this is 100 bits. And it's very close to the median. Now, do I have any theoretical significance to 100 bits? No way. But it is very, yes.
Well, can you do four positive trials where the CSUS interval is not fixed?
Yes, in fact, it wasn't. Yes, you can, but we haven't done it. Absolutely. No, absolutely. That's what we've got to do next, and that is indeed the next experiment on the block. It's obviously the to see whether there's any merit to these shenanigans. Yes.
Well, so what is the mutual information between the CS and the US? In all cases, is it the same? What's the number? So I know somewhat how to compare. There must be a way they could put some sort of scale on this 100 bits, right?
For one event?
Bits? I guess I don't understand.
No. I don't know what to compare 100 bits to, and I'm wondering what the mutual information between the CS and the US in your case is.
That's what it's.
Yeah. I mean, it's, so what's the spread? That's what those formulae.
What was the spread, or was it widely varying?
Across the different kinds of experiments, yeah, it varied quite a lot. Because, for example, the ratios of the two rates varied by two orders of magnitude in those experiments. Remember, in the simplest case, where you have a random rate process both within the warning stimulus and between it, right? The difference in entropy depends simply upon the ratio of the two rates, and in the data we considered, these ratio varied over two orders of magnitude. Yes?
I may have missed this, but at one point you made the deliberate assumption about the distributions being, the noise being normal.
Yes, the uncertainty being normal, yeah. There's evidence for that. That wasn't gratuitous.
Okay,
yeah.
So. That's still built into that eventual conclusion somewhere, isn't it? It's the shape of that curve.
Yeah, because in calculating the entropy in the fixed interval case, I assumed a Gaussian distribution.
But you said there's evidence.
Yeah, there's so from the kind of experiment that we were talking about, there's evidence that at least to a reasonable first approximation, it is Gaussian.
No long tails.
Well, okay. Now we get into a lot of. Whether there often is a tail, but sometimes there is. Now we get into complicated, messy experimental facts. I guess the first thing to say is that this is psychology, not physics, okay? So we're almost always talking about messier data than we are in physics. More often than not, there is a tail. But...
That's going to have a high impact on that computation.
Yes, it... if... Yes, the tail could have a very substantial impact on that.
The lower bounding the amount of information which is being...
There are reasons to think, not very compelling reasons, but there are arguments that can be made from data. People have investigated the factors that control the tail, and there's a reasonable literature implying that the tail is actually due to anticipation of what's... The tail in the data, right, is actually due to the intrusion of responses that are anticipation to what's coming in the next trial. For example, the tail is greatly diminished if you put a really long interval between the trials. Under optimal conditions, the distributions look very normal. That doesn't exactly license, but it supports the idea that the animal's underlying uncertainty, as opposed to what you see in the data, is Gaussian. But is that if you were skeptical about that, are the data such as to compel you? By no means. Yes?
I think you commented about this a little bit in talking about comparing this with other sorts of learning.
Yeah.
I'm trying to see what your opinion is, whether the mechanism in the animal is the same in this task and something in here, like based compared to some task where you actually have an experiment where there is temporal uncertainty and the animal has to actually localize in time the signal and the signal co-occurs with some other element that is highly visible, like a cue. So
That's this peak procedure.
But you would actually, the animal would actually have to make an actual decision in some way. I mean, it seems here that you're just basically, there's a reinforcer that co-occurs.
Yeah. Right?
And, right. But there is really no, you're actually measuring whether it's responding to the reinforcer, right? But there is
no, whether it's responding to the warning.
But
he's saying it's not a contingent task. It's classical conditioning.
Right. It's kind of more. I mean, just thinking more classical conditioning versus more.
Well, actually, all those. Most of these data were indeed classical conditioning data, but not all of them. The story looks very similar, whether it's instrumental or classical.
So I'm trying to just see how it generalizes to other sorts of learnings. Learning like we would actually do it like with humans, like in tasks where we actually give instructions and we get feedback.
Well, that brings us back to the question that was asked. Okay, so other sorts of learning. So what other sorts of learning there are? Well, there's spatial learning, for example, learning where things are.
That would be a good example.
This does not generalize in any straightforward way to that. Although certainly uncertainty about your representation is an important part of spatial learning. That's one of the other problems I'm interested in working on is the coding, the spatial coding scheme that allows the animal to deal gracefully with uncertainty, because the animal certainly has positional uncertainty and it does some kind of updating and so on. But except at the level that uncertainty is part of everything.
I was thinking of the position of uncertainty of objects of interest. Let's see, for humans and for animals, right? I mean, there is something like objects co-occur in the environment, so that sort of learning, where it's also, things could be probabilistic or could be, there are 10 things.
Right, so there's, spatial statistics, exactly.
Yeah.
To what extent are acorns likely to be found around oak trees, that sort of thing, yeah.
There's a few papers, and I don't know if you've seen the Richard Adlin and Joseph Pfizer from CBS at Rochester. They've had a few papers recently in statistical learning in infants.
Yes, I do know their work. Yes,
it's unsupervised, so it's very different. There is no, it's like.
No, actually, I think it's fairly close to this kind of thing.
Well,
I do think that this kind of analysis, and I think so do they. It is pretty close, that it's likely that you're tapping into very similar kinds of processes in these experiments as in their experiments.
Well, they do the same thing. I had never seen what you have. Yeah. They do the same manipulation, I think, was the Roscoe experiment, where they try to separate the conditional probability from the frequency.
Exactly. I mean,
that's the same. But what is different is there is no, is there a reward? I don't think, maybe there's some little...
The reward... I'm full of heresies, and one of them is that the reward is basically irrelevant here. The only reason the reward is important in this is that it elicits behavior from the animal. The animal cares about it, and therefore it gives us anticipatory behavior. There are other experiments in which you, the onset of one neutral stimulus, like a light, is predicting the onset of the tone, and then you do things later to get the animal to show you what it's learned, and it learns perfectly well the statistical dependence between lights and tones, even though it doesn't care about lights and tones intrinsically. I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say reward is like your U.S., right? It's
exactly. Right. That is, I think the fact that we're using motivationally important stimuli and they, quote, warrant is basically irrelevant. Partly because, of course, they're using sounds in their experiments, and these are human beings, and they're trying to learn languages. And there's every reason to believe that the human infant from... even when it's in the womb, is carefully attending to the statistical structure of the language. So there's some evidence that animals pick up facts about the language environment even before they're born. The intonation patterns, for example, because they can hear them in the womb. Yes?
Back to this fixed 100-bit threshold, which I find very hard to understand, because...
So do I, actually.
It shouldn't be.
It's too high.
Look, I mean, if I make the rates of these two processes really high, so there's a huge amount of entropy, but they're not very correlated, it's going to take me a long time to figure out that those, the US and the CS are actually correlated, which is what I want to know before I start.
Well, that's exactly the kind of what we're showing is that...
This 100 bits seems like it should, I mean, the bits should scale with the difficulty of determining that those...
No.
It's one.
No, it shouldn't.
Zero and one. That's so basically, what's shown here that you get information for 100 possible choices.
But the number of samples you take is going to be dependent.
The question is not about samples. The question is about total number of bits. So if the lambda CS and lambda D are very large and very close to each other, the Volkov ratio is almost zero, right? Then you will need to have very many samples to get to the same number of bits. And so what I'm saying is that you. It's not the number of samples which is important.
No, it's
the number of bits.
That's right. That's exactly what I'm saying.
Yeah. Samples.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying. But let me tell you what it is about the 100 bits that I don't understand. Namely, you can ask from a normative perspective, a reasonable decision maker, when should they conclude that this is doing predicting? And they should conclude much earlier than these animals do. I mean, 100 bits is a crazy amount of information. If you ask what are the odds that this is just by coincidence, right? The odds are astronomical against coincidence by the time you get to 100 bits. And I'm very puzzled about that. In fact, that's basically why I'm here. I'm interested in working on models that...
So when the number of like presentations is small, then presumably the animal itself has very bad estimates of these two rates that are in here.
But that's the point is... After a very modest number, you can calculate sort of how many presentations would it take when there's a 10-to-1 or 20-to-1 or 30-to-1 difference in rate estimate before you have overwhelmingly convincing evidence. And the answer is very few presentations, 3 or 4.
Right, but what I mean is that if every single instance of an unconditioned stimulus has occurred within like the conditioned stimulus,
right, which is what happened.
Yeah, if that's happened so far, and there have only been say 10 examples, then there's no difference between this training and one in which the background rate is exactly zero. Do you see what I mean? So I mean, if the background rate is zero here, then this formula.
Of course. You can never empirically justify a background estimate of zero, right?
Right.
For reasons we discussed at the beginning about mortality and so on, right? So
what I mean is, in these cases, there's no way to estimate the actual number of bits.
No, that's not true, actually. It seems to me there's a very reasonable default assumption, namely that there's an upper, you can estimate the upper limit on the background rate estimate, which is simply 1 over the time you've been observing, right?
Right.
So if you lived in New York for 10 years without an earthquake, you certainly can't conclude that there earthquakes never occur in New York, but you can, it's an unbiased upper limit. Yeah. And that, in a sense, works. So I don't think that's a problem. To me, the problem is why they take so long before they begin to respond. And it's made more acute by the following fact that I haven't mentioned, but this is the kind of thing I'm trying to get Ilya to help me work through. If you, once they begin to respond, if you now eliminate the predictive relation, so this is what I mean by non-stationarity, right? The predictive relationship itself is changing over time. And it also takes them a surprisingly long time to quit. But if you now do a couple of cycles of this, so you're cycling through, predictive relationship exists, predictive relationship doesn't exist, predictive relationship, after a very few cycles, wham! Now it doesn't take much time at all. Now they start to behave very much like ideal detectors. And in fact, you do this half dozen times, you get single trial learning. That is, the first occasion on which you, after you've reinstated the predictive relation, when the US occurs, bam, they go back to responding after a single experience, right? So there's a very big effect of their prior history. This is very reminiscent of the kind of thing that Van Stevenick and Bielek are looking at in the adaptation, the complex adaptation of sensory neurons, in which how they respond to an abrupt change here depends in intricate and interesting ways on the past history of such changes. And exactly the same thing is true for these animals, right? So it isn't as if they can't detect those first things. They detect it all right, but for some reason they don't respond. And most people just say, well, they're dumb. After all, it's a pigeon, right? but part of what emerges from the BLX kind of analyses is, look, the neurons are incredibly smart, and I don't think those animals are dumb. I think there's, I'm not happy with that explanation. I think if you understood, if you had a rich enough understanding, people are also slow in this regard. And I think there's a reason, but I don't know what it is. Yes?
What if you change the nature of the behavioral response by changing your unconditioned stimulus?
Yes, thank you. I'm awfully glad you raised that, because I kept saying that there are some conditions in which they're not slow, and in fact, I meant to mention that. If you use shock as the reinforcer, then it only takes 2 or 3 experiences, which is, I think, exactly your question.
And how many bits?
Very, you know, 5 or 6. Yeah. So, again, what that tells me is that they've noticed it perfectly well, right? There's a long period when they know that this is a warning stimulus and don't respond to it. And that period you can shrink to negligible when you use certain events like shocks. And I want to have a model that enables one to capture that kind of thing, and that also makes suggestions. There seems to be some sort of default assumption that applies about base rates, except trying to do it with Bayesian priors just doesn't work, because in a Bayesian calculation, the new evidence overwhelms any prior after not too much. And if you look at what you'd have to make the priors to the animal would have to believe that there was 1 chance in 10 to the 5,000th that the tone predicted the reward. That would have to be its prior in order to explain why it took so long to respond, right? And that's not a reasonable prior. So there's something more sophisticated than that going on.
But
yes.
Can't you do some
trials? Is in a typical rabbit experiment, the CS latency, US latency would be a half a second, and the interval between trials would be 30 seconds. So there's a 60-to-1 difference in the rates, right? Plus there's additional information from the fixed time, and we know the rabbits learn the fixed time because when they begin to blink at that latency. That is, they're closing their eye in order to protect the eye against that puff, and they correctly anticipate the time at which that puff is going to occur. Now, they had all the information you could wish to begin doing that much, much sooner than they in fact begin doing it. So I want to know what those rabbits are thinking.
Is it what they're thinking, or is it the length of time the cerebellar mechanism that's going to actually accomplish the behavioral reaction is taking to wear itself up?
Well,
is there anything the rabbit can learn fast?
Yeah, sure. If you do this, what I've just described about, if you condition them, extinguish them, condition them again, extinguish them, and so on, after a while, boom, they learn just like that.
Isn't it simply then a reflection of the belief about the world?
Well, yes, exactly. I mean, it's very clearly has something to do, there are two components to it. It's very clear that in the learning, their long-term experience about the stability or instability of the world has a big impact on their how they adjust to a local change. That is very clear. I did an experiment that I haven't described here that I keep torturing Ilya with it, trying to get him to help me explain it, that shows that very dramatically. That's one part of it. The other part of it is what you might be called, what's the default model of the world that the naive animal brings to it? Because you want to understand why this animal, who basically has no basis for believing that the world is either stable or unstable, in effect, is so reluctant to begin responding the first time you show him this relation under most but not all circumstances. That's the challenge.
I just wonder if what you aren't seeing is a difference in neural mechanism accomplishing the behavior rather than just a distinction between your priors about one situation.
I just don't see how that can... I mean, I understand what you're suggesting, but I don't see... I mean, for one thing, they... let's take rats. Rats, like rabbits, show very rapid responding when very rapid learning when they're naive, when the foot shock is the predicted event. But you can do eye blink conditioning with the rats too, and again, they're not quite as slow as the rabbits, but they're slow. Much slower than with shock. Takes them 25, 30 trials.
Humans, can you do eye blink conditioning
in humans? Yeah, absolutely. There's a huge literature on eye blink conditioning in humans.
So we know humans are smart.
Yeah, right.
It takes us a long time to do eye blink conditioning.
You know,
anecdotally, it takes. When I go to the eye doctor, right, and they do that puff thing.
Yeah.
I'm
embarrassed to say that although I've often had a look at the human literature on eye blink conditioning, well, actually, I'm recalling. The humans are reasonably slow, too, now that I think about it, because there's a guy named Pocassi who did a lot of this stuff. He used to do these Vincentized analyses in which he would plot the data backwards from the point at which they began to respond. And I'm recalling those plots, and those plots went back quite a ways, 15, 20 trials.
There's no
smell, but in here. Yeah, so...